come closer to winning the struggle for becoming a free man than any other individual that I have met. He didn't reach that goal without struggle. But because he won the struggle to be free, in the true sense of the word, he became a man whose influence has been good as well as far-reaching. Many of us present here tonight, and thousands who are not present, have led richer and fuller lives because it was our privilege to know Joe Gilbert, to read his articles, to hear his talks, and to spend time with him. Tonight, we're going to attempt, though in a small way, to show our respect, our admiration, and our appreciation. So, Joe, you've been asking me why you were here. I trust that from what I have said, that you now know why we're gathered here this evening. And it's our hope that we will make this an evening that you will remember with pleasure. Now, I'm honored to have the opportunity to be Toastmaster at this meeting. One of the outstanding features of Joe Gilbert's life has been the self-discipline and order of his life. I think those of us who have had the opportunity to be with him often and on many different occasions have always been impressed with the self-discipline and order that was present at all times. And Joe was just telling me that his doctor, who happens to be present here this evening and can verify the fact, tells him that he is perfectly normal, with the exception of a few minor ailments. But they are minor. He's feels quite confident that a man can reach the age of 88 and still have that type of health, I think is a fine indication of the type of a life that he is living and has lived. Now, the committee in charge has requested me to try to run this program through in rather rapid fashion, so that we can adjourn at a fairly early hour. If we are to do that, it will require a certain amount of self-discipline on the part of the audience, as well as a certain amount of organization on the part of the Toastmaster. So to accomplish this, there are certain rules that I would like to ask that we try to follow so as to give as many as possible an opportunity to bring a greeting to Joe Gilbert on this occasion. I shall call on just a few people for brief remarks not to exceed 5 minutes. I shall remain seated during the first 4 minutes of their talk, after which I shall stand And I trust that when you see me standing, that you will take pity on me and not leave me on my feet for more than that one additional minute. My doctor is present also, and he's interested in how strenuous I make these particular meetings and efforts. Now, for excellent reasons, there are going to be two exceptions to that rule. And when we come to that part of the program, I shall explain the reasons for waiving the rule. I asked one of our men a couple of days ago, how long have you known Joe Gilbert? And I expected him to say, oh, about 18-20 years. He said, I've known Joe Gilbert since 1916. Well, I immediately went to the nearest calculating machine that I could find, and I discovered that that added up to something like 37 years. Now, even 37 years represents a minor portion of Joe Gilbert's life. But nevertheless, it's entirely possible that this man has known Joe Gilbert longer than any of us here. And I would like at this time to call on Bill Westhoff for a few remarks. Bill?
That's what I get for not keeping my big mouth shut. But I will say that I have known and admired Joe Gilbert. I mean, if I state the occasion, he'll remember it. It was back in the cool or cold, raw Sunday afternoon in November of 1916. You remember that, Joe? In November of 1916 at Bryce Park in St. Paul.
That was 1917.
Was it 17? I'm not sure.
Sit down, Bill.
How keen that mind is, you'll get a better memory than I have. Well, yeah, on the occasion, in the early days, at the turn of the century and before, the Street Railway Company in the Twin Cities were notoriously anti-labor. I happened to have been active in the labor movement at that time as a union carpenter. And prior to that time, I had been an employee of the Twin City Rapid Transit Company. And I know what the conditions were, and I knew that they needed correcting. Several times they tried to organize. They needed organization, but each time that it had happened prior to then, someone sold out. The list was found out by the employers, and all the men were fired. Along about 1916, as Joe says, 17, which I believe is the correct date, they did get organized to the extent that they had enough of the men organized to strike to improve their conditions, which badly needed improvement. I know because I had been one for 5 years. Well, in order to encourage them and give them support, they called a general meeting of all the labor union people for a Sunday afternoon in November, and it was called to be held in Rice Park, which is right across from the library in St. Paul. Well, they had many, many well-known speakers, and possibly the headliner or the chief speaker on that day was Jim Manahan. You remember Jim Manahan, of course, Joe?
Oh, yes.
He has long since passed to his reward. And many other speakers. Well, to sum the thing up, we'd heard about the prairie fires out in Dakota, Montana. There was, I believe, some of the Curtis publications had a serial running, a Saturday Evening Post or Country Gentleman titled Prairie Fires, in which our friend Joe's name appeared quite often, Mr. Tomley's and others. To sum up the, you may say, what all of the other speakers had told them, they called on Mr. Gilbert. And that was in the days, of course, before any assistance by a loudspeaker or an amplifier or anything of that kind. An outdoor meeting, thousands of people present, Joe in the center of the stage, and there wasn't a soul there but what could hear you. Now, I'm saying this just to verify the fact that Joe existed at that time. And not in too much of a different form than today, with the exception he parts his hair different today. He doesn't wear glasses. If I remember you right, Joe, you had almost coal black hair, and you had a very nice part in it. Otherwise, there was very little difference in the change in his appearance, and so forth. Well, his speech, of course, was heard by those thousands. While the movie was on, the strike that was on, didn't win out at that time, the good work that Joe did that day encouraged them to the point, so just a few years later, they did win out and got their conditions so greatly improved, there's hardly no comparison with the before and the after. That was, a long, long time, and of course, since then, I've had the pleasure of having Joe riding with me in many hundreds of miles in the territory, district meetings, annual meetings, and so forth, and I have never lost the admiration which I first gained on that cold afternoon in November 1917, Joe. May you live long and prosper.
Thank you very much, Bill. Responsible for Joe's coming to Midland was the man who, incidentally, was responsible also for Midland, Mr. E.G. Cort. Mr. Cort is no longer with us. But we do have with us a man, several for that matter, but this particular man was quite close to Mr. Cort and Mr. Gilbert in the days when Gilbert first started in as editor of the Midland Cooperator. He has long been a friend, and like Bill, an admirer of Joe Gilbert. We'd like to hear a few words from Midland's credit manager, Mr. Glenn Tomlinson. Glenn?
Mr. Toastmaster, Mr. Gilbert, friends, I suppose in the lives of all of us, there are particular people who stand out as having a great influence on our own thinking and philosophy of life. Looking back over the years, too many years, I'm afraid, it seems to me that in my life, three men stand out particularly, having had a great deal of influence on my own thinking and my own philosophy of living. The first man was my father. And all three of these men were cooperatives, and all three were liberal thinkers. My father was a farmer, and I think a good farmer, but he always found time to do a lot of reading. He was a liberal thinker in politics and religion, and in the economic field. And it was through him that I first learned about cooperatives. The second man was E.G. Cort. And I think looking over this group of people, I don't have to say very much about Mr. Cort. I think that all of you knew Mr. Cort and knew what he did in the cooperative field. Mr. Cort was a liberal also. Some people might argue about that. I know that Mr. Cort started out as a conservative. He was raised in a very conservative family. I know because I have to marry his sister, and she's still quite conservative. But I think it was the influence of our honored guest that E.G. gradually, over the years, became a true liberal. I first met Mr. Gilbert, I believe, about the time he first came to Midland. I'd come into the cooperative movement in 1932, and I think Joe came with Midland in 1933. I came into the cooperative movement, I think, more as a protest. Protest over conditions that existed at that time. Having lost everything but my trousers in farming in 1921 in the Depression, and then again in 1930, I was ready to join a protest movement, and it seemed to me that the cooperative movement offered a great deal. Of course, when I came into the cooperative movement, I knew something about the operations, the operating techniques, But it was only after listening to Joe and talking with him that I came to realize the full significance of the cooperative movement. I came to realize that the cooperation was something over and beyond merely sales and gross margins and savings. I came to realize that cooperatives were people, organized people, and that through organization they could hope to obtain at least a measure of economic freedom. And also through Joe's teachings, it came to me that political democracy, unless it was backed up by at least some measure of economic freedom, probably didn't mean too much. I think Joe came to Midland at a very appropriate time, because I think he and Mr. Cort made a very good team. And it was during those years of the 30s that the great organizational effort was made. During those years, I think that most of, of our present affiliated cooperatives were organized. And Joe, of course, knew from experience the techniques of organization. And I think that they made a very strong team. I suppose that many people would say that Joe spent his life fighting for lost causes. And when you read the history of his life, why, it rather appears that way. But I wonder if there were lost causes. I don't think so. I think the road to freedom, the road leading up to Magna Carta and the Bill of Rights, the road leading up to Rochdale probably was littered with a lot of lost causes. But always we gain a little. We go forward, as we have done in this cooperative movement. It seems to me that our loss in losing the writings and the words of Joe Gilbert is especially significant at this time, because of the trend which it seems to me is happening, so we say, towards fascism, not only in government, but also in business. I don't know who will take Joe's place. I think it is a great loss to all liberal thinking. I've been in meetings many times with Joe Gilbert, and two of them stand out particularly in my memory. I think it was back about 1935, Joe, some of us down in Wisconsin conceived the idea of trying to interest the ministers of Wisconsin in the cooperative movement. We sent invitations out to all the ministers of all denominations, inviting them to a meeting in Madison. And we had Joe as the kickoff speaker. Well, the meeting went along pretty well for a while, but after lunch, it started to get a little out of control. And the longer it went on, the more speakers we had, the more idealistic it became, and pretty soon it was floating away up here in the clouds somewhere. And Joe finally got a little bit disgusted with the meeting, and I saw him make for the door. After he got over to the door, he turned around and he beckoned to me. So I went over and he says, "Come on, Glenn," he said, "let's get out of here." He said, "I know a little place around the corner where they have good English ale." Do you remember that, Joe?
I remember.
In 1937, I went down to Burlington, Wisconsin to organize a cooperative, a committee, an organization committee of 15 people in my overtime. I'll be through it just a minute. An organization committee of 15 people that set up, and I was going down there to organize a cooperative. Well, we sent out invitations to 200 people. We hired the Masonic Temple Auditorium, and Joe came down to speak. 15 people turned out, and most of them were members of the committee, and here we were in this big auditorium with 15 people. Well, Joe, he got up and he gave a speech, you know, and you'd have thought the auditorium was packed. Well, after the meeting was over, we went back to the hotel. I was very much discouraged and disappointed. I didn't think there was much chance of organizing a cooperative there, but Joe says, "You're mistaken." He said, "That was a fine group of people you had there." So There are a lot of quality in those men. He said, here's an opportunity to build a real cooperative. And he said, if you will go ahead here and organize this cooperative and take over the management, he said, I think you can really build something here. Well, I did. And as it happened, we did build a good cooperative. Probably one of the as good a cooperative and as sound a cooperative all down through the years as anywhere in the Midland Territory. So evidently, Joe could see something in that group that I didn't see. Well, I feel highly honored, Mr. Toastmaster, in being asked to pay some tribute to Joe Gilbert.
Thank you, Glenn. Closely associated with him quite early in that endeavor was another man who worked with him for many years and later took over the work of editing the Midland Cooperator. While he's no longer active on the Midland Cooperator, he has been active in Midland for many years, particularly with publicity, radio, and moving pictures, or film, rather. We'd like to hear just a few words from Joe's immediate successor as editor of the Midland Cooperator, Ivor Lynn.
You notice he said just a few words, which reminds me that at one time Joe told me that I wrote better than I spoke. So since I think probably he still believes that, and I do too, I won't impose my speech on Joe and the rest of you this evening. I just want to say that it is the 20 years next March when I first met Joe. Mrs. LeSueur, maybe you remember that little farmer labor club we had down in the 12th Ward. You came over there to talk to us. Joe came over to talk to us. That is my first introduction to Joe. And at the time, I believe George came over there on occasion, and we got started talking about cooperatives. And later on then, in the fall, just about 19 years ago now, I came over here to Midland and got acquainted with Mr. Cort and the rest of the group, and started working then in November as Joe's assistant. There could be, of course, a whole evening of reminiscences, but I won't go into that at all. I just want to say that it has been a tremendous pleasure and a great honor to have worked with a man like Joe, to have known him these 20 years. I just want to add one comment. You know, Joe spent 1 year in jail. And that particular thing, and now I think he was a little over 50 years old at the time. That 1 year was probably a very important year in Joe's life because, as he has said himself, it gave him an opportunity to read and to study a great deal more than he had ever had time to do before. And so far as I know, the jailer didn't put any restrictions on the kind of literature that Joe had there to read. Joe may have asked for Karl Marx, or for Henrik Ibsen, or for Shakespeare, or for theoretical treatises on philosophy and so on. I don't know what he did ask for. However, I think he had a very well-rounded year of reading. And then, of course, he had regular diet and regular hours and good sleep. In fact, maybe it would be a good thing to recommend to every executive just past 50 to spend a year in jail to kind of recoup a little for the next 30 years. Yes, there's economic security, too. Now, that jailer didn't probably, as I say, he probably didn't censor your reading material, did he, Joe?
Did the jailer censor your reading material?
No, you just went through the form of it, that's all.
In other words, he was a long time before these McCarthy committees and other things that we have now, attempt to determine for us what we shall read and what we shall think. I just want to say in closing that I think that democracy, whether it's political democracy or economic democracy, lives and grows only as long as the people have the intellectual integrity and have tolerance and have the information on which to base their thinking about the life that goes on around them. And to my mind, that last point, the information, is a very important thing, because tolerance and integrity depend an awful lot on whether we are in the position of having to depend on somebody else to tell us things that we ought to think and read, or whether we have real freedom in the selection of the information that we want.
The step into the editor's shoes in Midland was Dave Doffitt. Dave is not with us this evening, having left Midland about 2 years ago to go to another cooperative in Ohio. However, before he left, he did a rather remarkable job in writing a book on Joe Gilbert's life called Nobody Owns Us. I dare say that there are none of us here this evening who do not own that and have read that particular book. If you haven't, or if you have friends that you might think would like to read the book, if I can stick in this little plug here, we have it in the Midland Library, and it's available to you at the price of $1.
Autographed.
And it's autographed by Joe Gilbert. So some of you might, at some time or other, want to give the book as a gift, just write to the librarian at Midland, and you will have the opportunity to get the autographed book. I can tell you that it's extremely interesting reading. Dave Doffitt gave me the manuscript before it was printed. One evening when I went home from work, I started reading it and just about got in debts with my wife because I wouldn't come out to supper when I was supposed to. I finally did, had my supper, and then went back to reading the manuscript and kept on reading until I was through, which was far into the night. And then I got bawled out again. I left the manuscript at home, and when I got home the following night, there was no supper on the table. Instead of that, there was a very busy housewife reading the manuscript on Joe Gilbert's life. But we do have with us a man who is now the editor of the Midland Cooperator, and while his acquaintanceship with Joe Gilbert may not be of many years, I think it's of such a nature that we would like to hear just a few words from the present editor of the Midland Cooperator, Gordon Michaels. Gordon?
I shan't abuse the privilege of the few words. If the ladies will pardon, I surely am the youngest person here and the one who has known Joe the shortest time. My marks should be appropriate, I think, to that relationship. Joe, we've inherited from you a publication which had a lusty beginning 20 years ago, one I believe has gained in stature and influence throughout the period, and one which we hope you are trusting to the custody of people who will see that it continues to grow in influence and in stature and in effectiveness, converting people to these old basic principles that people working together, mutually and cooperatively, can make a better world than people fighting each other, cat and dog. Joe, we admire and respect you for the long start. I think of the publication as something that goes on regardless of the people who occupy the chair of the editor. And I say that, Joe, you started a Midland Cooperator that'll be here. I hope I'll be 88 years old to see how the editor then is handling his charge.
Following this report, as manager of Midland Cooperative, was a very tall and a very young man who had distinguished himself in cooperative work. And under his guidance, Midland has been growing year after year. He too has been a friend of Joe Gilbert's for many years, and I dare say that he has benefited greatly from Joe's friendship and from Joe's counsel. I have no hesitancy about calling on the manager of Midland Cooperative Wholesale. I have no fear that he's going to outrun his time, because I have discovered that to get him to make a speech is generally not too easy. But we would like to hear a few words from you, Art. Mr. Art Smeaton.
Joe, friend, my acquaintance with Joe doesn't go back as far as Bill and Glenn and George and Ivor and some of the rest of you. I knew Joe shortly before I came to Midland, and that is 17 years ago now. And I, at that time, looked upon Joe Gilbert as a wild-eyed radical that was someone a guy named Art maybe shouldn't know too well. Joe knows this, but many of you may not. I was brought up in the most conservative county in the state of Minnesota. Everything about my early life and all the way through was one of conservatism. I became a cooperator by chance and because I needed a job at the age of 23, not because of conviction. I knew George Jacobson before I knew most anyone else in this group. I became acquainted with George about the time that I began my work in cooperative. I suppose that throughout the years, one thing that Joe has said to me more than once, and the one thing that I remember about Joe and my relationships with him more than any other thing, is the number of times he used to come to my desk when I was credit manager, and the number of times he has come and visited us since, when he would say, "Art, it's a darn funny thing. You a conservative, and I being a radical, somehow can come to agreement on most things, even though we approach them perhaps from an entirely different viewpoint." Joe, I think you will recall how many times you have said that to me.
Correct.
Certainly there is no one that has influenced my thinking any more since coming into the cooperative movement than Joe Gilbert. And Joe, as younger men, men who are half your age, and hope to be able to carry on for quite a few years, we all salute you, Midland salutes you, and Midland thanks you for all that you have done for Midland and for the cooperative movement. May you live yet a long time and enjoy the remainder of your life as much as you have these first 88 years. Thank you.
Thank you, Art. You caught up about 2 minutes there. So that would normally give me a chance to talk, I suppose. There is one name that has been mentioned by quite a number of the speakers, a man who was closely connected with Mr. Court and Mr. Gilbert in the early stages. In fact, the three of them made a remarkable team and share a great deal of the credit for building Midland during those early years. He's no longer connected with Midland, but is very definitely connected and influential in another cooperative organization, Group Health. And I would like to call on George Jacobson for a few words to us and to Joe. George?
Thank you, Andrew. I really came here just to read a poem, but it's, of course, a great honor to
participate in any occasion which Joe Gilbert is the principal person to receive honors, because he is truly one of the giants of the earth of this movement, and all of us have learned a great deal from him. I can't help but add these remarks to the history of how Joe came to Midland, because I think some of you good liberals and radicals here will appreciate it. Mr. Gilbert came as a result of a plot that took place in the home of Amy Edmonds. I know Mrs. Lesser will remember her, and Mr. Duncan, who was the IWW mayor of Butte, Montana at one time. I happened to be renting a room in their home at the time, and he took part, and I took a little paper in Midland, mimeograph paper, which was called the Co-op Oil News. First mimeographed it, and later we printed it. We wrote it over weekends and while we were on the road. And as you know, I told Mr. Cord it was about time we got an editor. And Amy and Mr. Duncan told me about Mr. Gilbert. I had never met him. So we schemed to get him to come up here and speak at the annual meeting of the Northern States Cooperative League, I believe in the year of 43. I'm not too sure about the year. And just before the meeting, I got Mr. Gilbert to go, Mr. Cort and I, up to a meeting at Chisago City. Because I was sure if Mr. Gilbert meant E.G., he would sell himself, and he did. And E.G. got so interested, he said, "Well, that's just fine, but," he said, "how will we sell conservatives like Mr. Osborne and Mr. Klipfel?" And I wasn't worried about Mr. Osborne, but we never told Mr. Klipfel that Mr. Gilbert had been connected with that terrible organization called the Nonpartisan League. It wasn't until after we'd hired him, and by that time Joe had sold himself. Well, a few days ago, or some time ago rather, I guess Glenn sent me a letter and asked me to make a contribution to something that's going to be presented here tonight, and I was negligent in doing so because I was gone. And when I finally came to that part of the mail, it was just a few days ago, and I asked if I might have permission to make my contribution. And I've been sweating every day since to decide what to write, and I finally wrote, paraphrased one of the choice poems of Mr. Kipling, and it's with your permission, Mr. Toastmaster, I'd like to read it. This is to Joe Gilbert, Master Rebel, with apologies to Rudyard Kipling. When Earth's last struggle is ended, and hate has withered and dried, and the oldest prejudice faded, and the blackest lie has died, we rebels shall rest, and need it. We shall rest an eon or two, till Joe, Master of Rebels, shall inspire us to work anew. And those that were true shall be happy. We shall sit beside Gilbert's chair, splashing big league propaganda as atoms everywhere. And we shall find real rebels to learn from, Debs, Joe Gilbert, and all. Make speeches for an age at a sitting and never tire at all. Only experts like Gilbert shall praise us. Only fellow rebels shall blame. We rebels won't work for money, nor shall we work for fame, but each for the joy of building, and each in his separate star, shall describe the way as he sees it, to improve things as they are. Written and paraphrased with fond admiration, warm gratitude, and continuing indebtedness to my cherished friend Joseph Gilbert, for all he has taught me and inspired me to do.
Thank you very much, Jez. Well, we now come to a sort of a break in the program, in as much as we are partly because he has a very special function to perform. And I'm happy at this time to introduce a man who has probably worked more closely with Joe Gilbert in his years with Midland than any other single individual. Our educational director, Mr. Glenn Thompson. Glenn, will you take over? Well, Andrew, and friends of Joe Gilbert, Andrew and I got our signals crossed here a little bit. I was hoping that our honored guest would be given an opportunity to say a few words before we made a presentation. But I am going to, at this time, admit something that Joe has prodded me about for a little while this evening. I did not disclose to him the real intent and the purpose by which he was going to be invited out, even as recently as about 2 or 3 minutes after 6 o'clock, when I stopped down at 1822 Portland to pick him up. He was standing on the outside waiting to go some places. The bit was in his teeth and he was raring to go, and he remonstrated that I was late when Edith and I stopped to pick him up, and I apologized and told him that I knew that I was late. He said, "Where in the devil are we going?" I said, "Well, I think you're going to be talking to a bunch of Unitarians and help indulge in a money-raising campaign to lift the mortgage off the church." He said, "Well, by gosh, I did that once, too." But, Joe, I recall with some degree of conscience one day last July when I was wheeling down Portland Avenue and I saw you come out of your house, and I pulled up sharply to the curb and we passed the time of day, and you reminded me of something that some of us had neglected, in that you had just about 10 days previously reached and successfully passed your 88th birthday. Now, it was pretty hot to try to get the gang together. We even had a little late summer heat wave, and people were on vacation. And the first opportunity that afforded itself to indicate that we would like to get together and pay you some tribute and do it honestly and do it openly, because I think that we've had talks together in the past, that you're one of these individuals, if there's going to be any flowers bestowed upon you, you'd rather be sitting up looking at them. If there's going to be any nice things said about you, you'd rather be alive and to hear them. Now, we knew that there were a lot of people that would like to come to this meeting. And I took it upon myself, after consulting with some of our associates, to inform them that we were going to have a little party for Joe Gilbert. And I've received a number of written messages. And I'll admit that I've been reading your mail. And I'm not going to divulge any of the intimacies in these letters that have come. But we thought that one book had been, it wasn't the bestseller. And then we get informed here tonight, as Joe indicated, that by gosh, he was going to write a book and probably call it Reflections of a Rebel at Age 88. Well, I advised him not to put a time limit on it, because he might have to revise it at 108, according to what Dr. Friedel has told us about this old Constitution, which is, I still say, he can whip his weight in wildcats. But here is a book, Joe, that has not been authored by one person, but has been authored by a lot of your friends. And I'm only playing the part of a middleman. I transmit that to you after having read a few of those pages. And I'm going to make a very special request. Do it very openly, that when the time comes that you no longer need that book, we should like for you to think of Midland and make a provision that it shall go in the Midland Library. Now, I think after you have cogitated on some of these things and before you open it, that you probably would like to have an opportunity to rebut to some of these things that have been said about you here this evening.
Well, I'm all right now.
Advisable to call on any more folks, but I do think that there's some time. It's not quite 9 o'clock. We do want to hear from Joe. Now or later, but if there are any of you who would like to express a few words to the group and to Joe, the floor is yours. We're sent to you from friends at Group Health. This bouquet of flowers from Group Health.
Group Health?
Some of the friends of your friends there.
Well, Andy, I couldn't pass up this opportunity.
Is it necessary to introduce this gentleman? This is our distinguished congressman from District 3, Mr. Roy Weir.
I want to say, Mr. Chairman, and friends of Joe Gilbert, that when I received this invitation to attend this little affair tonight in your honor, in honor of a long length of very valuable service to the cause, I was happy to be able to be here without any other commitment. I heard the figure used tonight of 1916. In 1916, I had just graduated from the apprenticeship of the business which I was engaged at that time in the theaters to a member of the union. Shortly after that, I went into the military service and served 18 months. I went in very much the same as some of those who have spoke here tonight. I came from a family, a grandfather and a grandmother, but my father was tempted to be quite conservative. I think he got that from being appointed to a postmastership in Turton, South Dakota in the 90s. Following the war and my experience in the war, I became deeply concerned with experiences that I had there. And so when I came back, in 1919, I became very concerned and very interested in what this union meant that I belonged to. And as a result of it, I became a delegate from my local union to the Old Trades and Labor Assembly on Fifth Street and Third Avenue South. And there I got my introduction into the struggle. And I loved it. 1922 was my first introduction to Joe Gilbert. Joe Gilbert could always be found where the little people were engaged in the struggle. Not to inject himself into some place in which he was not wanted, but to volunteer his services and whatever contribution he could make. Because it was during the days of the 20s that the very weak labor movement of this nation was confronted with an onslaught by the American employers for the open shop drive. And they were taking them one at a time. And Joe used to come over to the Old Trades and Labor Assembly many, many times. At the same time, we were carrying on our political activity under the auspices of the Nonpartisan League. I've heard Joe a number of times during those days campaigning for our Minneapolis municipal ticket led by Tom Van Leer and many others who have since passed away. Later on, I became associated with Joe in the Northern States League that somebody has made reference to when they were holding very substantial conferences every year or conventions up on the northern part of the state. I think I attended about eight of those. And again, I had the occasion to find Joe there. Wherever there was a struggle going on in which the prerogatives of this great mass of common people were involved, Joe was there. Joe has contributed much to the efforts to make tomorrow a better day for a great mass of people, not only in this country, but around the world. And one of the things that disturbs me more than anything else, Joe, today, sitting in the halls of the National Congress, is the insidious program dictated and financed and promoted by a very well-organized group, a of Americans, at least they're termed Americans, who want to still voices like yours. Today, they're using security risk as a danger to our national safety. But in the final analysis, Joe, as I have watched the McCarthys, the Bellies, the Jenners, and the rest of the crowd, I see this program that they have enunciated under the cloak of patriotism and safety and security to our nation. I see it as a direct challenge and a direct attack upon labor and all people who might think and act and carry on as you have acted. To still the voice that challenges their authority and their position and their special privileges in this country. And I'm sure, Joe, that there'll be many, many more voices to carry on where you leave off. And I want to say, Joe, with all of my associations with you, in the labor movement, in the political movement, in the cooperative movement, you have done everything that you possibly could to do, as I said a minute ago, to make tomorrow a better day for those who toil and those who struggle on. And I want to extend my gratitude for all of those efforts that you have committed. And I want to wish you Godspeed and another 88 years of activity. Now, I haven't found out yet, Joe. I'm just as much in the dark as you are. In the Midland Cooperator, I read that you wanted some rest, and the Midland Cooperator was going to make that possible. Then I got a letter that Joe Gilbert was retiring. I don't think you are going to sit here and take that land down. And then I've heard that you are on the way up. Now, I don't know what that up means, but that you are not being disassociated. So I refrain now from wishing you Godspeed in retirement or in your rest or in your promotion. You'll have to find out which one it is.
Dean Cardinal, pump priming for the big industry and the business. That again may be necessary, and it is necessary at times. You see, it's based, however, upon the wrong philosophy. It's the question of, well, you help the rich, and then eventually it'll trickle down to the poor. There's an illustration of that. It's a little bit crude, but it's merely feeding the horses so that the sparrows can live. And that is not... You know, that wouldn't be so bad if the digestive system was always in working order. We must help industry and big business and so forth, but the theory of trickling down to the poor eventually is fundamentally both undemocratic and also inhuman. All human beings have rights to be helped to help themselves and not through the means of somebody else. Let's keep that in mind. Now, you see, you have charity and then the trickling down theory. Then you have, of course, that which is the proper and the right system of helping people to help themselves. The 0.4 program, the Food and Agriculture Organization, the UNESCO, WHO, those have programs of helping people to help themselves. Again, we have to watch out in these programs, in the 0.4 program, which is just beginning as a matter of fact. We must not plan on impact spending for lasting results. Great big appropriations are not necessary, and in most cases, they're actually harmful. To throw in a lot of money into a country, you cannot appropriate money and throw it into a country unless there is wise spending. Dr. Bennett, who was killed on one of the trips, as a matter of fact, I'd seen Dr. Bennett and Mrs. Bennett and his party in Rome, and we were to meet in Tehran for Christmas. I got there on the 22nd, Saturday, the 22nd of December in the afternoon from Istanbul. I landed at 3:30 and the airport closed down. Heavy snow came. By 7:30, his plane from Baghdad began to circle. I was out at the airport. It circled and circled and circled, and it tried to come down and land, and it circled again and tried again. Finally, the pilot said, I'll try it once more. We were waiting. Not a sound anymore. And we took it for granted that they had gone back to Baghdad, lost contact. The next morning at 8 o'clock, no one had heard from the plane. And all of them killed. They hit some little low-lying hills. And poor Dr. Bennett, one of the greatest men that America ever produced, his wife, Albert Crilly, his assistant, Jim Mitchell, Ben Hardy, the publicity man, killed. I went out the next morning, and I can't even want to repeat the details, but he was one of the men that said, let's not spend too much money. I prefer to spend a little money and give back the money that has been appropriated to the taxpayers unless I can use it properly. And I hope that that policy will continue in the point four in the technical aid program. We must also get down to the grassroots approach, to the extension method. The slower we work with those things, the surer we are going to succeed. And then here is a very specific point for you who believe in cooperation. My own personal belief is this, that the point four program, the technical assistance program, as we go out into the various countries to help people to help themselves, we'll never succeed unless we get the active cooperation of the people who are there. Now, there are techniques to be used, and the techniques to be used are the cooperative techniques. I'm here to make a very special plea to you as the leaders here in the Middle West to insist upon the technical assistance leaders on the State Department, with your legislators, with your senators and representatives, to insist that cooperative education and cooperative techniques, that actually cooperatives be organized in those countries, in those villages, before we allot any particular funds or instruments or tractors or whatnot to those places. Now, there is an obligation on your part. You believe that cooperatives build up a democracy. You believe in these things, so do I. And I'm telling you that we're going to waste our money, we are going to waste our efforts unless we actually insist that cooperative techniques, cooperative education, be used in the allotment and in carrying out the point four or FAO or UNESCO or WHO programs in other parts of the world. That is your obligation. It's being done here and there. I'm afraid there is a tremendous danger. Now, you know what cooperatives are, what cooperatives are created for. You have had that great privilege of having used cooperatives for your own improvement, should insist that our own State Department, that our own technicians abroad, never launch upon one-sided projects, or merely having the other government take a portion and say, well, it's a bilateral agreement. But see to it that these agreements come with the people themselves, down at the grassroots, or otherwise our money is going to be wasted and it's not going to do any good to the people. I would even suggest that from now on, the program of CARE, which has been a wonderful program of sending packages, be stopped as packages, and rather, and not merely send even plows or hoes, but actually help people help themselves by the formation of cooperatives, local cooperatives. Give them all the assistance, give them the education, because otherwise it's that continued charity, it's that continued wasting of money, and actually demoralizing and pauperizing a people, a nation. Let's start with small projects, humble projects. Oh, if you could just see some of the projects that the Near East Foundation is carrying on. I saw them in Iran. I saw them out of Damascus. Little bits of things, absolutely, really and truly, they don't amount to nothing. But oh, how great those things are. I saw them up near Salonika, in a little town called Liti, not far from Salonika, where girls were exhibiting the first canning of fruit that they had done. What a wonderful thing that is. Then in another home we went in, and one of the home economics, American home economists, had taught the old lady of the house how to salt down some ham and to make some sausages. the first time that they ever done that. They were eating the pork just right after it had been killed because they couldn't preserve it. What a wonderful thing that is. How it's going to multiply. Little humble projects. I saw fruit trees being planted in the schoolyard of a Turkish village. There is the place. And then multiplied by thousands. Those little projects, the Near East. You know how much could be done? Just the very simple projects. In India, Dr. Miller is the authority for this figure. Last year, when they were hungry for wheat, for flour, actually, it was figured that 2,500,000 tons of wheat were wasted because of rats. Well, you've got to just see to it. We sent them, after a lot of haggling and a lot of nonsense in Congress and in the Senate, we sent them 2 million tons of wheat to help the starving Indians. A little bit too late for some of them. But if we and if they had actually taken care of killing the rats that ruined 2,500,000 tons, we wouldn't have to send the wheat. And those are the things that have to be done. It's possible to develop. How wonderful it was for me to see the agricultural school on the congregational auspices up at Salonika, Dr. Houses, who his father had established the school. What wonderful teaching. And then the Quaker.
Somewhat younger man, I should perhaps be the one that should bring cheer to you. I'll have to admit, Joe, that there has been times when I've asked you to travel with me in order to bolster my courage, in order to help me carry on. And you have done that time and again. And for that, I want to bring you my personal thanks. And then may I have the honor of introducing or presenting to this audience of friends the grandest old man that I know in the cooperative movement, Mr. Joe Gilbert.
Mr. Chairman and friends, I have listened to all these eulogies that have been bestowed upon me this evening and must confess that I do not feel that I was entitled to them. I hadn't the slightest idea what this meeting was about. In fact, when Glenn Dunstan called for me this evening, I didn't know that it was to be here even. I thought I was going to accompany him to another meeting. But I will try and make as clear as I can in a few minutes my appreciation of this tribute that has been paid me this evening. Those who have known me, those who are here, who have known me the longest, as has been well stated by one of the speakers, is but a fraction of my life. We are all constituted differently, and as Shakespeare has said, the world's a stage and we are actors on it. Each plays his part and passes on. My part has been my interest in human society. At a very, very early age, I might say even as a boy, I was interested in other people. And after I became a member of the bar in Philadelphia, I was inveigled into it by a friend of mine who appealed to my cupidity at that time and stated that I would be able to make as much in a month as I was then making in a year. And I was making good money in those days as a head designer. But I was not in the law very long before I saw that the principles of law and the practice of it were at variance, a vast difference between them. As I grew older, I began to realize that life was a struggle. a struggle first of all for survival, a struggle from then on for development, for reaching out for something greater than the individual himself. And as I stated just now, we're all constituted differently and we contribute in different ways. And I may say to you that the greater part of my life, almost all of it, has been spent in what the world calls lost causes. They haven't been lost. Very early in life, I began to apply the principle of evolution, not only to organic life, which every educated person accepts today, but to society as a whole, that struggle goes on continuously. It takes different forms. Those different forms are determined by many factors. I'll mention a few of those factors. The material development of the race, which isn't the same all over the globe. The degree of development of agriculture, of industry, of temperament of the various peoples, because we're all different in different parts of the world. In manners, customs, traditions, religion, all our factors determining that. But the struggle goes on. It's going on at a high tempo today, although many are dead to it. They don't realize it. I think you will all agree that life has been continuous. It has been a continuous change. That doesn't mean necessarily that it's always for the better where it takes place, but it changes. Change is the one eternal thing that exists forever. We see it everywhere. We see it all throughout nature. We see it with human beings. And while in this country we may pride ourselves, and justly so, upon the remarkable advances we have made, that probably we have attained a greater degree of material success than others, than other countries I mean, while all that is true, I don't think anybody within the sound of my voice will admit that what we have achieved is the ultimate human endeavor. There's bound to be something to follow it, which will surpass it tremendously beyond the scope of our imaginations today. Let us remember that the present has grown out from the past. The present is the child of the past, and likewise is the parent of the future. That's evolution going on all the time. And today we are in one of those critical periods where what exists today has served its purpose. It must give way to something else. That something else may be worse, it may be better. That will be determined by our actions of today. There's no doubt about that in my mind, and neither will there be in yours if you give a little serious consideration to it. Now, it was stated tonight, I think Ivor Lynn was the one who stated it, that it was a good thing for me that I spent a year in jail, 3 months more in another jail, making 15 months. I agree with him. It was the best thing they could have done for me. Why? Because I adjusted myself to that which was inevitable, and I made the best of it. And I probably gave myself an education during those 15 months far greater than any young man that goes to the university. I know very well that I read more books on vaster and wider subjects than they do at the university in one man's period of education. I hadn't been able to do that before. Why? Because I had been engaged in a strenuous struggle. It was long before I came into the cooperative movement that I was engaged in this struggle. It may surprise some of you who don't know me so well to know that I was one of the founders of the present Socialist Party in America. that before the present Socialist Party was formed, I was a member of the old Social Democratic Party, which was brought to this land from Germany by Germans, that I engaged in that actively, giving all my time to it, gave up the practice of law to engage in that struggle. I was the first state secretary of the Socialist Party after the present Socialist Party was formed. It was formed at what we call the Unity Convention, of bringing together the various people who call themselves socialists or social democrats into one party. And I was active in that, not only because I was the first state secretary in the state of Washington, but I combined with that organizing. I gave my whole time to it. I was one of the promoters of the IWW, that much maligned organization. I traveled as a freelance over this country preaching industrial unionism before the IWW was formed, and attended the first convention that it was called in Chicago in 1905. I edited a socialist paper and got together a printing plant and published it in 1901 in Spokane, Washington. I have done the same thing with other parts of the country with socialist papers, also with labor papers. I was thoroughly conversant with the cooperative movement before I came into it. Now, I'm not going to indulge in too long a talk about myself, but I'm going to tell you why I came into the cooperative movement. I recognized, and here I was at variance with some of the leaders who were greater men than I in the Socialist Party, when I said to them, the Socialist Party is only an educational factor. It can never be a political party. I said, you don't even understand Karl Marx. Karl Marx said, if you read his writings, and these people who blare about him today don't know the first thing about him, he said, keep close to the heart of the labor movement. The labor movement, Mr. Weir, is the coming force in this country, because after all said and done, you may talk about your ethics and your morals and everything of that kind, but the one thing that counts is power. Power. Now, I've been asked sometimes, what do you mean by power? Let me see if I can illustrate it in this way. What is the difference between a savage and what we call civilized man today? The use of power. He has learned to understand the forces of nature, to harness them to his bidding. What goes on after that is done? Again, it's power between the conflicting group interests in the nation. We have it here today. Throughout the length and breadth of the world, that is going on. And in these days that are so confusing, that are confusing even our statesmen and the so-called bigwigs throughout the country, there's nothing new about it. The only difference between this and the past is its scope. It's worldwide. Why? Because man has developed communication and transportation that's brought the peoples of the world together. And to our shame, I say today, that instead of America being in the forefront of this struggle for freedom and democracy, what is it doing? It's trying to gather force by getting the most reactionary elements in the world together, arming them, giving them billions of dollars of your money to maintain the status quo. They can't do it. It's ridiculous to try. History is against them. You can't stop ideas. They will go on. You may deport the men that give voice to them. You may put them into jail. You may execute them. But those ideas go on. You can't kill an idea. And therefore I say, we are living today in one of the most remarkable periods in the history of this world. Why is it remarkable? Because it's worldwide. It's got a tremendous sweep. Now, why did I go into the cooperative movement? I don't think I've told any of you this, because I realize that in the evolution of society, we've got to be able when we overthrow one power, we've got to be able to exercise those necessary things. And the cooperative movement today is a school in which people are learning to conduct their own life, their own ideas, their own work, their own means of getting along one with another. Many cooperators don't fully realize that. There's a principle underlying the cooperative movement that we should always stress and never lose sight of, and that is this, that it is democracy applied to making a living. Political democracy is much like a promissory note. It's of no value till you cash it. And therefore, our political democracy is only of value as we understand how to apply it to our everyday needs. But before we can do that, we've got to learn to work together to supply those needs. That's what the cooperative movement is doing today. And when Mr. Smavey said, and I thoroughly agree with him, I've said to him more than once, it's strange, you a conservative, I a radical, and yet we so often come to the same conclusion. Why? I'll tell you the way it appeals to me. I recognize the necessity for doing the expedient thing, not, however, as an end in itself, but as a means to an end. I could agree with Mr. Smavey in those expediences of today. Radical though I may be in my ideas, I'm simply looking ahead. The only difference between men like Mr. Smavey and others who are just as intelligent as he is in the business world is this. They regard that as an end in itself. I regard it merely as a means to an end. That's all. It's the equipping of the common people to do the things they need in their everyday life, but they can't do it alone. They have to do it in conjunction with others, more so today than ever in the past, because it's absolutely necessary. Not only is it necessary, mind you, for us to work together in the spirit of democracy, which exists in the cooperative movement for that particular group, but the consumer cooperative movement has no limits. It invites everybody into its ranks. It gives the benefits of everybody, to everybody, I should say. There's the beauty of it. And therefore I can see that all those radical movements in which I have been an active factor for the biggest part of my life, they've all been necessary. First of all, you've got to agitate. You've got to wake people up. You've got to make them realize that they mustn't be satisfied with the condition in which they are, that they must understand the conditions under which they live. Then you've got to, after you've agitated them, you've got to organize them. And that's what we've been doing. And today, what is going on today, to a very great extent, larger in this country probably than any other country in the world, is organized groups contending with each other. That's what's going on. Now don't forget that that's what society is, organized groups. The individual is given way to, through his necessity, mind you, to the group with which he is affiliated, whereby he gets his own living. We have the labor movement, the men who sell their labor power, both of mind and muscle. They organize themselves. We have the employers. They organize themselves. The chambers of commerce, the bankers, even the professional men, the farmers, all those are all organizing themselves for the respective, for the benefit of their respective groups. That's the picture before us. But it can't stop there. It's got to take in all of humanity. Now, is that a vision? Is that wishful thinking? Oh, no. Is that the result of your ethical teaching and your preaching? No. It's the result of necessity. Great though this country is, mind you, it's dependent, in order to maintain its greatness, upon certain things that only exist in other parts of the world. And that's why the struggle is on today, fiercer and greater than ever. And what we're witnessing today, and to which too many of us are deaf to, is this. They are using more subtle means today than they did in the past. In the past, it was the struggle simply between the employing class and the employees, in which they used brute force. And the great men of today imagine, and they're talking it from the president on down, that the only way in which we can achieve peace is by force. Military force is what they mean. They're deluding themselves. It's got to be something more than that, far more than that. And the reason that it is so worldwide is because we are dependent one upon another throughout the world to maintain our present status of life. That's what's doing it. And therefore, the principle of cooperation, Mr. Smaby, is the leading principle of today. It's the really practical proposition. And some of you in the cooperative movement have got to realize that. You've got to begin to realize, for instance, that those who are engaged in cooperation for as producers, others again as consumers, must come together. They must form a larger unit than they've got today. They must exercise power. That's the point. And that's why I'm in the cooperative movement. It's the climax, you might say, of all my experiences of the past. And I might say, mind you, that out of those 88 years, that probably 70 years of that time, I've been engaged in this struggle. There are some who facetiously laugh at it and talk about the class struggle. The class struggle, Mr. Thompson, exists today at a greater tempo than ever in the past. Within my memory, what we call some of the aristocrats amongst the workers, school teachers, men of the press, and those kind of people, they were too good, they were too independent, too individualistic to join a union. The most advanced of them have got beyond that today. And the latest, whether you know it or not, is that some of the technicians are joining in with the labor movement. And I'm telling you tonight that when the hour comes that any very considerable number of those technicians join with the labor movement, and the professionals are what we call the intellectuals, furnish what you might call the officers of that great industrial army of workers, then the present system has cracked. It's a thing of the past. The only reason, mind you, that exists today is because we accept it. We think that it's inevitable. But those so-called great men today, what are they? In the main, they're a parasitical growth upon the body politic and economic. They could all die, but those corporations go on the same. But take away the technicians and take away the workers, take away the educated people that we what we call the intellectuals, and what have you got in society? Nothing. It's a delusion. That's why I'm in the cooperative movement, and I'm talking that way tonight because it's the cooperators here who have honored me in this manner, and I'm talking probably as more for their benefit than for the rest of you, but something for you to think about. Now then, one last word, and that is something that Mr. Michelson wrote in an editorial. He said that since he has got to know Joe Gilbert, time has had a different meaning for him. Now let me say why I'm able to do what I do today. First of all, it's no great credit to me. I happen to have been endowed with a fairly sound constitution, with which I had nothing whatever to do. Then having had inherited, you might say, that sound constitution, I began to develop it. As time went on, I realized, for instance, that man's speaking of man in the generic sense, including women, is triune in nature. He's physical, he's mental, he's emotional. All three aspects of his nature need to be nourished and developed. And in proportion as he's able to do that, he is the master of his fate. That's a thought worth pondering over. And therefore, I expect to be around for many years yet. I don't only mean a senile, staggering old man. I mean all the aspects of my nature I expect will function until the last. And then they will go out just like you blow out a candle. That's the end of me. But my work will continue. The other elements in society, the younger ones, will take up the same cause and carry it on. And in conclusion, let me say this, that however dark the present may be, if we only have our eyes fixed upon the future, not living in the past, excepting as a guide for the future, but always our eyes on the future, each playing his part according to his talents and his capacity and opportunity, so progress will continue. And that's the lesson that I have gained through my 88 years of life. And it is a great satisfaction to me to know that there are always some people everywhere who can appreciate that sort of thing and who will join with me too in helping to carry on the work, so that when I am through or when my efforts become feeble, others can take it up from where I leave off and carry it on to its conclusion. And that conclusion is not the acquisition of property for the individual. No. It's the development of the individual. The development of the individual, mind you, in those three aspects. Physical, mental, emotional. So that according to their respective bent, they can carry on the work, not acquiring and benefiting from the work of others, but in leading others in that work to a much higher civilization than the world has yet ever known. I thank you.
Cannot fail to be an inspiration to all of us, not only because of what you said, but the knowledge that in front of us lie many years before we reach the age that you have reached. And it's my hope that we too will be able to maintain that spirit, that faith in the future, that not only will keep us going, but will help to build on the foundation that you have helped lay for us. I don't know if anything else can be said. If any of you, I don't want to cut this off, if any of you want to say a few words, there's still time to do so, or you can do so in private. Joe will be around here for a little while. The suggestion has been made that some of you may be visiting the Midland Building for the first time. If you have, or rather, you may be visiting the building for the first time in some years. And if that's the case, and if you're interested in seeing some of the very major changes that have taken place within the Midland Building, we shall be happy to take you on a tour of the building after we adjourn and after you have talked to Joe. I don't know what is the best way of concluding a meeting of this type. It appears to me that what we attempted to do was to give Joe an evening that he would remember with pleasure. I hope we have done that. I know that he has given us an evening that we will remember for many, many years. Thank you very much, Joe Gilbert.
Thank you.
And we stand adjourned.